Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome. I am so glad that you're here with us today. Listen, we have got a great show lined up for you, as always, and we have a great week lined up for you, a lot of exciting things. And I hope that you are following along with our 52 Habits for Healthy Parenting. Now, this is a challenge that I gave you all back on January 1st to say, hey, this year, join me in intentionally investing in your parenting journey. Now, there's no test, there's no failures. It's just basically give your best good faith effort. And every week, we'll be talking about a new habit that you can adopt and habit stack, as we've been talking about, stacking these habits on top of each other to really invest in your parenting journey, because there is no magical cure or life hack that is going to transform your parenting. But consistent dedication and working on your character over time, I promise you, you take that journey and that is where the secret is. That is where God has given us that. It's really not a secret on how to be a good parent. So if you can believe it, we are already in week 14 of this year. And so far, the habits we've explored are prayer, memorizing scripture, plugging into a local church, listening to Christian music, practicing gratitude, listening with your face, having a bedtime routine, sleep hygiene, a daily devotional, a morning routine, playing together, affirmation. And last week we talked about letters, writing your kids letters. And I'll put a plug in. I know that it is April 1st and you may be thinking, yes, April Fool's Day, but April is actually also National Card and Letter Writing Month. So just a reminder that it is such a generational keepsake to write something handwritten for your children to pass down to generations and to go back and to read those words when they need encouragement. This week, we are talking about family dinner. Now, if you have read my book, Behind Closed Doors, or if you're a regular listener of this program, you know I feel so strongly about the power of family dinner together. Now, this doesn't mean jazz music and candlelight and gourmet food. This just means that you are intentionally sitting down together at a table connecting, whether it's over peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but it doesn't matter, but you need to be tech-free. That's my plug. And today we've got a guest who's going to talk about that, who has a book that is releasing tomorrow. So I'm so excited to be talking about it. Today we have Dr. Ryan Rush. He is a pastor of Kingsland Baptist Church, which is in Katy, Texas, in the suburbs of Houston. He spent more than 20 years working in ministry, and during that time, he has been on a mission to connect church and home life, and he has become a national voice for the Faith at Home movement. In over a decade serving as adjunct professor at Liberty, he taught more than 1,500 students the course he helped design, Theology of the Family. He has hosted numerous radio and TV programs, and he's the author of 3 books. And this book we're talking about today is called Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connections of Meaningful Mealtimes. So Ryan, he and his wife live in Katy. They've got 3 girls. He's a dad. Ryan, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you here.
It's such an honor to be with you, Dr. Peck. Thank you.
Well, it is an honor to be here, and we're friends now, so it's just going to be a conversation between Jessica and Ryan now, which I love. You are now sitting at my table, okay? I am at my table, and I'm inviting you to have a conversation. And, you know, Ryan, I'd love for you just to start by telling us just a little bit about yourself and about your family and how you came to this point in your ministry and where this passion has come from to write and to draw members of your church and the larger church, the big church, yes, back to the family dinner table.
Thank you so much, Jessica. So I'm a pastor, as you said, and one of the things I learned, I don't know whether other ministry families face this challenge, but when we used to try, when our girls were younger, have like family devotions, which I highly recommend, sometimes it came across as really contrived as a pastor. You know, it felt like I was assembling a lesson plan or trying some things that I might use later on. And so it was a little clunky in a pastor's family. But we found that dinner times or meal times were wonderful times to do the very same thing. We're already gathering around, remove the distractions, maybe bring up a discussion question. And so it worked really well. Didn't always execute perfectly, but it worked well for us. And so about 9 years ago, I was the pastor of the church where I pastor now in West Houston, and I issued a challenge. I said, what if we committed for 40 days to 5 meaningful meal times for each week with the ones we loved? And I expected that to be, honestly, Jessica, a good starting point where people could sort of just kind of sense this is a nice habit and they'd enjoy some time and maybe allow for us to get to some really important things later on. What I found out, though, was that those mealtimes together became significant in a major amount of our homes. They found they could be transformational for a lot of families. Marriages began to be reconciled. Parents who had not been communicating well with their kids found that this was the mechanism, the platform to do it. Teens were all of a sudden having conversations of meaning with their moms and dads that they haven't had in a long time. And so I became hooked on this idea of mealtimes with families.
Well, I think I can't agree with that enough, because research backs that. Research backs that families who have meals together, their kids are less likely to engage in risk-taking behaviors. They're less likely to experience anxiety, depression. They're more likely to do well in school. They're less likely to do drugs. I mean, just it goes on and on. And I love what you're talking about with this habit stacking. This is what I call it, because we have these essential disciplines that we need as parents, just like you talked about. Daily devotionals. But there's no reason you can't combine that with mealtime where you're already there. I just absolutely love that. And the other thing that I think is great is that we know that that number 40 is very significant in scripture. It represents a time of trial or preparation for great change, because some of those examples are God flooded the earth for 40 days and the Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and Jesus fasted for 40 days and nights. So what a great period of challenge. Well, Ryan, you open up in the book talking about a dinner you enjoyed in Somaliland in Africa. So you're talking about your dinner table in Houston, but also in Africa. And of course, that's an area that's experienced civil war and economic difficulty. What did you learn about sharing a meal with people from across the globe?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because that place is just come back up in our lives significantly. We opened a school just a few years ago in memory of a dear friend of ours, some friends of ours who'd lost their son in a tragic accident. And so we were there for this. My wife was just there meeting some of the same people. 3 weeks ago, we dedicated the Lily Rush School for Special Education. So we have a daughter with special needs, and there was nothing like that serving people with disabilities in the entire country. And so the meal you're talking about ended up having these ripple effects where we just got back and have forged some strong friendships. So you illustrated it so well, Jessica, but Somaliland is not a place generally where there's a lot of Christian mission going on. It's a 100% Muslim nation, and yet they needed to build schools, and so we were not quiet or coy about being Christians, and they welcomed us in. At the same time, when we went to dedicate this school, as you can imagine, they were a little bit standoffish because they knew we were Christians. We didn't have a lot in common. We're going to create the school and have the conversations. But it was over a mealtime after the school dedication that everything changed. So we sat down around this meal with a bunch of meats that I'm not sure what they were. And it's one of those situations where you really didn't want to know exactly what you're eating. All I can tell you is Somaliland is the number one exporter of camels in the world. So that gives you an idea what might have been at the table. So I'm sitting there with this guy who didn't want to have anything to do with me. He was a government official. And yet, when we sat down, we started to eat. And I said, tell me about your family. Everybody wants to show you pictures of their family. So we started that. And then I wanted to know how he got involved in education. And he just went on and on. And within 20 minutes, I'm looking around this table, Jessica, and maybe 20 people, some mm-hmm. Americans, some from our church, and others there, and lots from Somaliland. And the walls had just come down. There's something about food that is this common denominator, this great connector that allows it to happen. And I realized watching this that this is not just some great discovery I've made. All through the scripture, you see that take place. I mean, most of the book of Luke, if you look at it from that perspective, is Jesus having meals with people. He did over and over again. And so not only is this a value to your family to sit and have those meals on a regular basis, but when you welcome someone to your table from outside the circle, something powerful happens.
I can't agree with that more. And, you know, I had a similar experience, Ryan, when I was traveling abroad. I was actually on a mission trip in India, and I had never been to India before, was working in a hospital there. And one of the chaplains invited us to his home for dinner. The team that I was working with, there were probably about 10 of us. And as we went, you know, I saw that, of course, this was a place that did not have any electricity and didn't even have any doors. There were just open openings with maybe a sheet over it or maybe not. And what this chaplain had done was to go and he went to a construction site and he borrowed some 5-gallon buckets and then turned them upside down. And we were sitting knee to knee. That was our chairs because, of course, there wasn't furniture to accommodate us. And what we realized was that he had been saving his money to be able to buy us food to eat because food is expensive. And in India, they don't really use reusable paper products, but he knew that we might feel afraid of eating food off of dishes that had been washed in their water, that we might, you know, fear that we would get sick. So he had saved his money to buy some disposable things so that we would feel comfortable. And Ryan, same thing, you know, the meat was passed around, didn't know what it was. I think it was goat, but I will say it was absolutely delicious. And as we were all sitting there eating, you know, we had been working together, but we just started to weep, like just one by one, just weep at the generosity. And he just kept saying, like, thank you for sharing my table. This is such an honor to me. And we were thinking, oh, no, you can't even imagine. Like, that was one of the most moving experiences that I had. And I love how you illustrate that, Ryan, that really eating together and then even thinking about those biblical references, that is something that's a common human experience. And you use a phrase to describe the outcome of that meal that you talked about in Somaliland. And this phrase is cultivating an openness for an ongoing alliance. Now, what we see across the world is just division, just polarization, and just fear. So what's the best way that we can cultivate that openness for an ongoing alliance? How does all of that fit into this global picture?
Yes, Jessica, you know, it doesn't have to begin around the world as we're talking about. It can begin in our neighborhoods. And I've seen this in my own cul-de-sac where I live. We've been able to build relationships. In West Houston, where I live, our particular zip code is the most ethnically diverse community in America, meaning I'm more likely to live next door to someone of a different cultural ethnicity than anywhere else in the country. And so our neighbors are Hindus from India. Their neighbors are religious but non-churchgoers from the UK. Their neighbors are atheists from China. Their neighbors are from Houston, and their neighbors are from Louisiana, which, let's be honest, that's sort of like another country, right?
Yeah, so that's right.
We've gotten to know one another. And the really cool thing about it is we now share meals on a quarterly basis in our cul-de-sac. And when we made that offer, let's get together and do this, no one was averse to that. Now, if we would have said, hey, let's get together and have a small group, or let's get together and have a conversation about faith, there would have been some major pushback. But everybody's okay with food, especially when you can say, hey, bring something from your own country. And we've done that. We've shared desserts at Christmas time with everybody. But I'll tell you now, we've had the opportunity and privilege of sharing our own story and hearing some amazing stories from them. And we see this through the Bible. I'll give you one biblical example.
Well, hold that thought, Ryan. Hold that thought. I want you to give us that example. We're up against a break here, but don't go away because you want to hear that example that Ryan is going to share from the biblical application for our lives, which is just never ceases to amaze me how such an ancient document can have such, that's a living word that has relevance for our lives today. And we'll also find out what happened when Ryan challenged his own church to take this challenge and some of the stories that came out of there. Don't go away. We'll be right back with, we'll be right back. Why is our society so ravenous to abort babies? According to a former Satanist, the demonic forces have a bloodlust for the innocents and sickly believe their blood sacrifice empowers evil. Make no mistake, we are fighting a spiritual battle as we protect the most innocent among us, babies in their mother's womb. Preborn stands on the front lines of this battle, and their network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, often next to abortion mills where unspeakable evil takes place every day. Preborn offers God's love and life to protect hurting women and precious preborn babies. And every time a baby is saved, which happens 200 times a day, good conquers evil. Please make your most generous gift to empower good and rescue precious souls. For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound that doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial pound 250 and say the keyword baby. That's pound 250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey friends, and welcome back to this conversation I'm having with Dr. Ryan Rush. He's a pastor who has written a book that's coming out tomorrow. It's called Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connections of Meaningful Mealtimes. And if you were listening before the break, we were talking about the science of this. This is not complex, but it's also not easy to do in today's pace in the world where we're living at the speed of a smartphone, where sports can be king and where we have all of these activities that our families are involved in. And some of those are good activities, but they take away from that mealtime. And sometimes it's not. Sometimes we don't have our priorities right. And this is a habit that I have adopted with my family. And like I said, some days it's just peanut butter and jelly that we're passing around like on paper towels. I know it's barbaric, right? But we are still having that time of connection where we're looking each other in the eyes and we're saying, hey, what were your highs and lows? And where did you go? And tell me about your day. And as a mom, that tells me how to pray for my kids. It gives me a pulse on how they're doing, what they may be struggling with, what they might float at the dinner table as something small or something big. And not only with our own families, we've been talking with Pastor Ryan about extending that to families in our community and even around the world. And right before the break, Ryan, we left on a cliffhanger and you were just about to tell us some more biblical examples of this. So I'm going to let you take it away from there.
Sure, Jessica. Thank you so much for having me. And when we talk about kind of building bridges through mealtimes, we mentioned the book of Luke and how often Jesus did that. But it's really interesting that one key moment in the life of the church, the history of the church, happened with Peter having a vision in Acts chapter 10 related to food. And it had to do with food that was not kosher. So dietary issues were keeping the Jewish Christians from really reaching out with others because it was presumed that that was going to happen around the table. And so God gave a vision to Peter basically saying that food would no longer be a barrier for the gospel, which is kind of really cool to think about because we don't often put the two together. It's amazing how food overflows into every area of our lives. And Jessica, you mentioned from a medical standpoint, all the studies that are out there. So Science is catching up with what the Bible said all along. But there are strong motivators for families to get involved in meaningful mealtimes with the ones they love, not only for dietary reasons. You know, those correlations make a little more sense. But when you talk about the outlook of kids, less involved in teenage drinking and premarital sex and all sorts of things are tied in, correlated at least, to this one thing that you wouldn't normally think is that important, but it's so significant in the life of families.
Well, you're talking about a story that has one of my husband's favorite Bible verses, Ryan, which is Peter, get up, kill, and eat, which is what my husband will say because he loves to eat. But, you know, it's interesting. There's a parallel here because the founder of American Family Association, Don Wildman, he started this organization by challenging his church. He challenged his church to forego TV for a week. And then look at everything that's happened here. And you challenged your church to come back to the dinner table. And you did a little experiment with your own congregation. And so tell us how that went and what you learned.
It was really amazing. So we used that 40-day number, not because it's a magic number or it's a habit builder, but we knew if people could commit to something, we can do almost anything for 6 weeks, right? If we could do that, we felt as though we'd have some habits that would continue, and that's exactly what took place. So we knew, as I said, it would be something that would be well-received anyway. What we didn't anticipate is, first of all, that it exposed some really rough habits that we had gotten into as families. People were sharing, you know what, we didn't realize how long it had been since we'd had a meal with no technology, just as you're mentioning Don Wildman did. It makes a huge difference, and people don't even realize that the TV's on in the background, and they may be sitting there, but they're not really connecting with one another. And even worse, we all have the experience. I mean, if you go out to eat anytime in the next week, look around and you'll see families eating together, but no one is connected because everyone, mom, dad, kids, grandparents, they're all looking at their phones. And so if you will just make a concerted effort to get those out of the way, you just had a major victory anyway, because it might be the only time that you have all day where you're focused on one another. And then what we found was, okay, now we're having real conversations about real challenges that no one has had before. And there's something about having that food at the table that allows the conversation to flow naturally and in an authentic way. And so kids started sharing things with their parents that they hadn't really talked about before or in a long time. And so through that, we got into some deep waters. We ended up seeing some redemption happening in homes that we didn't anticipate. Kids sharing things with their parents that they hadn't before, that needed help. And it was just extraordinary. And so there were legacies that were changed because of something, of all things, as simple as a challenge to those five meaningful meals.
Well, you're right. And I see that. I see that just as a person, like you said, when I'm out, and it makes me so sad to see how tech has hijacked our communication. And one of the things that I know, Ryan, is that eye contact is really important when we're having communication. And when we have those phones at the table, it takes away our eye contact. And I've shared this on the show before that when we make eye contact for at least 20 seconds, it causes our kids or whoever we're with, it causes our brains to secrete bonding chemicals. It causes us to secrete dopamine and oxytocin that make us feel physically bonded to that person. And there's a lot of research coming out where kids are really calling out their parents. A lot of times, you know, as parents, we bemoan all the time. Our teens are always on our phone. We can't get their face out of their phone. Well, the honest truth is, Ryan, they're learning it from us. They just really are.
Yes.
And we are giving up that God-given advantage that he's built into their brains. And some of the other research that has come out has shown that having just a phone present during the conversation at dinner, it negatively impacts the physicality of digestion. Like, it gives you indigestion just having that phone there, knowing that you're not important. And I think, especially in America, this may be an unpopular thing to say, but you know, we have a fast food culture. And when you travel to other countries, a lot of countries do it better than we do, where they sit down and they really enjoy a meal over time. Like, there's no hurry up, I need the check. You're just sitting there. And so what can we learn? You know, you've traveled globally, but what can we learn about slowing down our meal time to make that a priority?
Oh, yes, Jessica. You know, my wife and I went with the family to Italy several years ago, and it really stuck with me. I talk about this in the book, how we noticed that we as Americans were the ones who went to their table. Everybody else was already at the table, and then we got up. Everybody was still at the table. So they just anticipated this was going to be an event that lasted all night. It wasn't something that, well, once you completed the meal, you go. And so once that took place, then they're just enjoying the company of one another. If you ever travel to Israel, not only do you see lengthy meals take place, but of course, in the Jewish population, what you see is Friday in Israel. You'll see all these flower stands pop up everywhere because when people are on the way home from work for Shabbat, they'll be taking those flowers to the family, to mom who's preparing the meal, and they'll set those at the table. And everything around their time of rest is surrounding the significant meal where everyone is present around the table for a long period of time, and they're talking about the deep things that matter. Now, the other side of this, Jessica, that we have to say, I just want to highlight something you said that's so important. You said sometimes you just had peanut butter and jelly, and that was enough. That is so important for parents to understand. We're not talking about recreating a Norman Rockwell painting. We're not trying to create a four-course meal. That's not the point. It can be a really simple meal. It can be breakfast. It could be something along those lines. It doesn't matter. What matters is the technology's out of the way. You're having intentional conversation. Everyone's present, and you've invited the Lord to the meal. That's what makes the difference.
Oh, I love that you said that everyone's present and you invited the Lord to the meal, because that can be something that it just seems so rote, you know, that you just, okay, let's say the blessing. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's a lot of families that it's very easy to get out of the habit of doing that or never to really be in the habit of doing that. But just that simple act of saying grace together, of sitting around a table, I prefer for everyone to hold hands, like everybody grab a hand. Let's have that physical connection and invite the Lord to our table and acknowledge that God is the giver of everything that we have. He's the giver of life and our food. And just having that simple moment of blessing is one of those examples of a faith rhythm that really bonds families together. And these are the authentic practices where your faith is caught more than it's taught, because you can sit down and have, you know, the best prepared meal with the best prepared devotional with the best theological, you know, Dr. Ryan Rush is at our table going to lead our family devotional, but they really want that authentic. And, you know, I think about it. You talked about being in Italy. My in-laws are Italian and they're really good at this. Like, I will go to their house and they will sit for a long time at their table. They don't have their phones, and they give our kids a feast of undivided attention, which is something that we don't have very much. And that's something that I want to get into here, Ryan, because you talk in the book about the impact of COVID-19 on social interactions. And we've got kids who literally do not know how to have in-person social interactions. Just the thought of even ordering something at a fast food counter will give them palpitations. And so how do you see this impacting, and what do you call for in the book to help families counter that those patterns that have emerged from COVID?
Oh, you're so right, Jessica. I agree 100%. While COVID was wrapping up, I was wrapping up my PhD studies in leadership, but I was looking at the correlation of leadership and attachment. So attachment's a fancy word for what God said all along. We deeply desire these emotional connections with others, beginning with our parents. But I think there's a lot of kids with attachment injury from COVID because they didn't connect, and then moms and dads were busy on their technology and they didn't have that connection. So getting back to mealtimes create a natural connection with a lot of ways that physiologically we need. There's meaningful touch. There is eye contact. There are words of affirmation that take place across the table. So it has to start there. I would encourage parents who are trying to restore some of what was lost to use some simple conversation starters. I have some on the website. There are a few in the book. They don't have to be complicated, but if, like for our family, it might have been as simple as, hey, everybody go around the table and tell everybody the best thing that happened today and the worst thing that happened today. And then they feel heard. We can share these things. sometimes we would draw in one particular passage of scripture, or we might mention something on the news and then have meaningful conversation about that. But you have to get them talking, and they need to feel heard.
Well, you just used a phrase that I think will be unfamiliar to a lot of listeners, but you used the phrase attachment injury. And you're right. That is something that we are looking at, because during COVID, you had 1.5 billion children around the world who were all of a sudden cut out from every social network that they had. They were cut out from school or extracurricular activities, from their grandparents, from their churches, all of those kinds of things. And then, yes, you had parents who were trying to figure out how to work from home and how to put food on the table so that they could even come together. Right. And what I saw, Ryan, was kids going to their devices for that connection. And, you know, you talk in some of your information here and in the books about trends that emerged from that. One of them that we've talked about here is bed rotting. Now, this is where kids just literally go to their bed all day long. They stay in the same clothes, they eat junk food in their bed, and they scroll through their phone on social media or binge watching a show all day long. And that's what's happening. And they were having those connections, but they're really pseudo connections with technology, because they don't have that physical touch.
Yeah.
They don't have eye contact. They don't have, you know, a good meal, even if it is peanut butter and jelly. I keep saying that, but that happens a lot. And so what do you say to families who, because I know you have families in your church, I'm sure, who are struggling with this, who are thinking, we got into some really negative habits during COVID, and we haven't quite shaken them, if we're going to be really honest. And we picked up some things that we do now that we didn't do before. How do you encourage the people in your congregation, Ryan, to start a new path?
Well, Jessica, you know what's really tragic about that? The time that we were kind of forced at home, the period of time, could have been the great transformational moment for families, because they had time together. And so for so many, we became just as isolated. And you say, well, why is this so complicated? God did not make this complicated. He made it natural for us. We were created for connection. And so we have all these distractions today, more than we've ever had. And so what used to be natural now must be intentional. And that's what I'd say to moms and dads. Well, what do? Just be intentional. So coming all the way back, I know I sound like a broken record, because I'm fired up about this.
Mm-hmm.
But if you will commit to at least 5 meal times a week, just say, this is going to be a non-negotiable. I know it's not going to be easy. I know you're going to have to say no to some things, but if you'll do it, it'll make all the difference in the world. Say, we're going to seal off an hour. We're going to have a conversation. These are going to be scheduled. They're going to be special, and they're going to be spiritual. If you'll just do that, the research bears it out, and the scripture certainly supports this, it'll make the difference.
I agree. And I love it when you see that synergy between science and scripture, because God made science. But when we look at that, all of those things do go together. And now listen, Ryan is giving away not one, not two, but 3 copies of this book, Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connections of Meaningful Mealtimes. We're going to give one away to the first 3 callers at 1-888-589-8840. That's 888-589-8840. And you can get your copy of Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connections of Meaningful Mealtimes. Now, when we come back, we've got a lot more to talk about. And I know we keep saying some of the same things, but are you doing it? Can you commit to 5 meal times a week? That is the healthy habit of this week. That is the purpose of this book. We're going to talk about how to extend that mealtime from your table to your neighbors. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, welcome back. We are talking to Dr. Ryan Rush. He's a pastor of Kingsland Baptist Church in Katy, Texas, just in Northwest Houston. He is an adjunct professor at Liberty, and he is the author of his latest book that's coming out tomorrow called Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connections of Meaningful Mealtimes. And we've been talking about this as just something essential. If you are not having regular mealtimes together with your family without technology present, then Ryan is challenging you to do just that. Now, Ryan, I would love for you to tell us about RestoreTheTable.org and where other churches can be a part of issuing this challenge to their congregation. We have a lot of pastors who listen in and a lot of church leaders. And how can we amplify this challenge that you're issuing to the Christian community?
I would love to do that, Jessica. So first of all, for an individual or family who's listening, if you say, I want to take this challenge, if you'll go to RestoreTheTable.org, there are a number of resources that can help get you started. Some conversation starters, some guidelines, some brochures, that sort of thing that you can download. It's all free on RestoreTheTable.org. So if you want to get your church involved, this really kind of a fun thing that's taken place. We had this challenge in our church, and we're doing it again 9 years later, beginning this coming Sunday for us. But this is available anytime. There are a number of churches in our area that are going to do this with us, and this is a growing phenomenon. So fun to watch, where churches collectively are saying, let's challenge one another to begin on such and such a date and go for 40 days and take the 40-day table challenge. So for us, every household that wants to do it is going to sign a table out in the foyer of our church and say, let's do this. And there's something happens when you do this collectively, because you're encouraging one another, you're swapping recipes and strategies and sharing stories. And so it seems to work really well when large groups do it. But all the materials are there, including some sermon suggestions, outlines, data about meals, all at RestoreTheTable.org.
Well, I love that you're getting churches involved in this. And you know, Ryan, I've got four kids. Two of my oldest two are in college. My younger two are in high school. And when my oldest went to college and she got involved in a local church, there was a family there that started inviting college students to their home to feed them on Sunday afternoon. Now, this is, you know, something that takes a lot to invite college kids into your home, but you don't have to have the best house. You don't have to say, oh, I'm not set up to entertain, or, oh, I don't make gourmet meals. I mean, if you feed them, they will come. They're college students. Their bar is low for free food. But also on their house, they're not looking for the nicest house or the nicest food. They're looking for community around that table. And Ryan, I will never forget when my daughter called me and told me how nice it was to be in someone's house, to be in a home, yes, gathered around a table, not eating in a cafeteria, not eating by yourself in a dorm. And I think that, you know, sometimes we overlook as a church community those kinds of people, that those people who are in transition stages of life, who might be college students, or those people who are single. And you talk in the book particularly about the importance of eating together. And in this world where I see kids just more isolated, again, with their phone for, they may be even eating live on Instagram or TikTok and saying, here's what I'm eating all by myself. Like, how can we as a church embrace those people and invite them to our tables?
Well, hats off to your daughter for accepting that invitation, first of all. And so I want to speak to the single individuals or those who are living alone, because you might think, well, this is not for me. It would have been great if I had somebody in my home. There's a reason I chose the language, to commit to five meaningful mealtimes with the ones you love, because you may have someone in your church family, someone in your community that can you commit to, but no one should eat alone. No one. I mean, Jesus didn't eat alone. He's connecting intentionally with those ideas. And Jessica, another thing that I love that you said is when families do open their doors, not everything is gourmet or perfect. I perceive that the reason a lot of people don't invite their neighbors over, or that single adult who lives down the road, or welcome others in, is because they're waiting on everything to be perfect and Instagrammable. Mm-hmm. And this is the problem that's shutting down this whole issue where people don't do it. Because listen, if you would just leave that basket of laundry on the sofa that's half folded, you'll actually make people feel more comfortable because they got a basket of laundry on their couch at home and they'll feel more at home. So we've got to stop trying to create this artificial persona and just welcome people in. They'll feel more at home if everything's not perfect.
That's so hard to get over because I'm a firstborn of five. I'm a perfectionist. I'm a type A, and I think that. But you know what started happening to me, Ryan, when I was brave enough to finally invite people over with a basket of laundry on my couch? Like, they started folding it. They're like, oh, hey, I'll help you fold while we talk. And you just have to lay down your pride and keep yourself humble, you know, that God, the Lord humbled me in that way. But that is what people are looking for, that community, and to break down that facade. And, you know, talking about other groups of people who may live alone, Ryan, I remember very distinctly one woman in my church, precious woman I've known for a very long time. And she had been recently widowed, and I was talking with her about how things were going. And she told me, she said, you know, what is the hardest thing of all that I didn't expect? And I said, no, I don't know. I would like to know. And she said, walking out of church on Sunday and seeing all of the families leaving and talking about where they were going for lunch and who they were going with and walking to my car by myself. She said, that's the hardest thing. And I just thought, that's the hardest thing, you know, and what opportunity for us. And you mentioned in your book that when you share your table, you find yourself in a position to redeem someone else's table. So tell us, what do you mean by that?
Well, sometimes when we talk about the title, Restore the Table, yes, we want to restore and elevate the priority of the table. But some people need to restore the table in a redemptive sort of way because they have some real pain from their past. And when they think about their home life, it wasn't so great. But there's something that happens around the table that allows you to bring redemption. There's some transformation that takes place to say, this might be my heritage, but it is not going to be my legacy. And so I've seen that over and over. I tell the story of a young man named Mike. I just talked to you last week in the book, who had a really difficult family past. And the Lord put us together. He was a single young man in the Army who was serving near our church and started to go there. And we had barbecue every week together. And we remained close friends. He now works in Washington, D.C., and God is using him in amazing ways. But he allowed me to share his story in the hopes that, you know, it would bring redemption to others. But it wouldn't have happened without the mealtimes. And it's hard to explain, but it's true. And, you know, this has a biblical precedent. Exodus chapter 12, maybe the most significant mealtime in history, the Passover, when you consider that it was carried over into Christ's Last Supper. The lamb that was shared by the households in Egypt and then for generations afterward, one of the passages there, verse 4 says, you are to get a lamb, roast the whole lamb, and if you have too much lamb for your household, you're supposed to go find the neighbors and welcome them in. And so I think that's a deeply spiritual thing that's happening, that we go find those people, that no one eats alone, that we have too much blessing in our own house for just our household, and that is to be exported.
Well, you just said something so profound. I love what you said about this may be my heritage, but it's not going to be my legacy. And just in finding the redemption through Christ, what you were just describing. And of course, we just experienced Easter, and we know that we can have that redemption. And what better place to talk about our spiritual growth than at the table? I mean, honestly, we all should be eating three meals a day. And what I think about, even as parents, what opportunities we're missing for discipleship, for relationship building, for connection when we're not doing that. And Ryan, in your book, you actually provide some conversation starters. You talked about those earlier. And those may sound, you know, it may sound to people like it's awkward, but I will tell you, I will encourage you to be authentically awkward. I say this all the time. So even just like, yes, I'm awkward. This is awkward, but we're going to do it anyway. So I did this actually at Christmas. We had my whole extended family together that went out for a really nice meal. And we wanted to do this for Christmas. And we had kids And we had teenagers and we had young adults and we had middle-aged adults and we had older adults. I may have been one of those older adults, but then we had grandparents. But I passed around these cards before the dinner started, and I paired everybody up in conversation with questions to ask for each other. And let me tell you, Ryan, they all looked at me like, really? Are you serious? Like, this is weird. This is awkward. I don't know if I want to do this. But afterwards, I'm telling you, I mean, there was such rich conversation between grandchild and grandparent. There was rich conversation between, you know, an 8-year-old girl and a 17-year-old boy who could find a common point of interest and share points of their faith. So tell us more about the conversation starters that you have at the end of the book and help parents push back that authentically awkward place just to do it.
Yes. So, Jessica, I'm glad you asked that, because I totally agree with you. Having a conversation starter can be just that little nudge. And so the questions that I put in the back of the book are not something that you couldn't come up with on your own. That's one of the reasons why there's maybe 30 there. I know that once you get in the groove, you'll be able to come up with them. The idea is to have some talking point that's going to press the envelope just a little bit, not to make things awkward, but to cause you to go a little bit deeper. So, for example, when it says, hey, when are you or when have you been most afraid? I mean, everybody can pretty much share that. It can start on a lighter note, but it might be something where even if you're just getting to know someone who you welcome to the table, they can probably tell you the answer. Or something even lighter, talk about, you know, what do you think is the ideal age? Well, that's something a 5-year-old could answer or a 70-year-old could answer. Anybody can answer that question, and it's going to lead to why. And so there needs to be some open-endedness to those. We have some more on the website, some conversation starters, but they're just intended to be that icebreaker. But I'd even go a little bit farther, as you did, Jessica. They're more than an icebreaker. They're steering you into something a little bit deeper. They're raising the bar of the conversation that's going to happen, moving from small talk.
Well, you are a dad, Ryan, and you have 3 daughters, and you know, and you're married, of course. What does this look like as you're entering into this time of intentionality with your church? What is that going to really look like for you at home? Because I think, you know, sometimes people can think of pastors, and I, you know, I talked to another pastor last week, and I said, it's not like you walk in the door and I'm sure your daughters don't go, oh, the pastor is here. Let's listen to the words of wisdom that he has for us. So what does this look like for you as a dad, realistically, in your home?
It just brings a smile to my face to think about it. First of all, our girls are older now. So we have a 30-year-old, 27-year-old. They obviously don't live at home. When we get together, we treasure those meals. When they were younger, It was a little less formal than you might imagine. We usually had a stack of books over in the corner that might stimulate conversations. You remember years ago, Focus on the Family had some books called Sticky Situations. They may still exist, but they just have sort of a scenario. You know, you're in class and somebody wants to cheat on your test. What are you going to do? Things like that. And so we'd start on those. Now we might bring up a life event or talk about memories or just bring up a conversation starter. Our youngest daughter is 17 years old. Her name is Lily, and Lily is disabled. She has she's largely hearing impaired, is nonverbal, has an autism diagnosis and a rare genetic syndrome. And so life around our table is a little bit different, but it's the most spiritual event that we have. Lily cannot talk, but she loves to pray. And so she'll look at us. She's kind of the prayer police, and she'll fold her hands and say, now it's time. If we have an extra course of food, she wants to pray again. And we've found that she is intensely interested in the conversation that takes place. And so it's a wonderful blessing in this season of connection. And going back to the attachment piece, I would even say it's very important. It's critical, kind of mission critical for us to connect with Lily around those mealtimes, because she needs to be known and heard and present in those moments. So they're extra special for us at the Rush House, and I'm glad you asked.
That is really special. And, you know, as you go through different life stages, I found that same thing too, Ryan. I mean, there are some days, and now we don't have all of our kids in the home, but when we do, when they're all home together, like they were just this last weekend for Easter, ooh, having that time together at the table and having those norms established where they know we're all going to sit down, we're all going to put our phone away, and we're just going to connect around a simple meal, you know, whatever that may be. Those things are so important. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing with us your wisdom and the call, this challenge. Can you do 5 mealtimes a week? Go to get your copy of this book, Restore the Table, Discovering the Powerful Connection of Meaningful Mealtimes, and go to restorethetable.org to find out how your church can get involved. And in the meantime, friends, may the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. And may he give you peace. And we will see you right here next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.